Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Old Fashioned on Purpose podcast. So today's topic is a really important one, but I also feel like it's a really sticky topic for a lot of homesteaders or prospective homesteaders. And it can kind of be an elephant in the room that we know we want to get into or deal with, but it can be a little bit iffy sometimes. And that topic is the idea of butchering for ourselves or helping other people butcher. What is it like to take the life of an animal? How do we do that in a humane and ethical way? How do you handle all the emotions that come with that? Are they good? Are they bad? I hear all these things talked about so much in homestead circles that I wanted to have someone on today who can help us process all of that information and more. So I was so excited to come across Harmony Cronin. Just her description alone caught my attention. She calls herself an off-grid warrior Viking princess for the apocalypse. Like, how awesome is that? And she has worked as a professional big game skinner and has helped run a mobile slaughter in Montana, where she learned all the ins and outs of processing animals. She now teaches classes on what she calls the honorable harvest, which I just love just the title of that even, and also DIY animal slaughter, and focuses on using every part of the animal. And so, Harmony, I just loved seeing more about you on your website and on social media. And so I'm really excited for this conversation. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So you live a very unconventional life, which I think is so fabulous. Can you give the listeners just kind of a little bit of background on who you are and what you do and why you've chosen to live the way you do?
Sure. Yeah, I didn't grow up this way. I actually grew up in Denver in a big city, and my family has never even seen a dead animal, I don't think. So when I was a teenager, I started yearning for something, and I didn't even know what it was. And it kind of set me on this whole trajectory of traveling around and learning a bunch of different skills. And it eventually set me on this path of connecting with the land. And I realized that was the healing that I was really, really desperate for. And so through various things, I've lived in a lot of different places and kind of communities and environments. And I landed on off-grid in a canvas wall tent, completely off-grid, like no solar panels, no running water, no electricity in canvas, which does not have any insulation. So it's kind of been, I think I'm 5 or 6 years year round in a wall tent right now. And I've spent a lot of time kind of calibrating to a really earth-based kind of cyclical way of life. And animal processing started almost a decade ago. Picking up roadkill was kind of my introduction into how to be in relation with food and with animals, especially. And it's led me down a path where now I have skinned and eaten almost everything from a rat up to a buffalo. So I have a lot of experience with a lot of different types of animals. And, but I have a lot of other kind of hobbies and interests too. You know, the animals are kind of my specialty, something I dedicate a lot of time to, using every part. So right now I live on a ranch with some other friends in a community, and we grow a lot of food and raise critters and slaughter and try to live in a simple, kind of slow kind of way.
I love that. And I want to get in. I have so many questions for you, but I just cannot help but ask, how does the wall tent work year round? Because I know you're in a place with winter. You're not in like the tropics, right? You have winters. Tell me just a little bit of the logistics. We won't turn this into an episode about canvas wall tent life, I promise, but I just need some more information.
Yeah. So yeah, we get about 4 feet of snowpack, maybe 3.5, 4 feet of snowpack. So I live in a very wintry place, and I have a wood stove. Okay. And I keep a fire going all the time. My fire never goes out unless I leave for a couple days. And so I just keep a coal bed going, and it's cozy. I have a thermometer in there. It's usually 75, 80 degrees in my wall tent, even when it might be negative something outside, and the corners of the wall tent will freeze. Like if I have water out, the corners will freeze, but it's toasty in there and I'm comfortable. And I think after a while, the first couple of years were kind of rough, the learning curve. But you acclimate and your body changes and you spend a lot more time outside anyways. And I don't know, I love it. Having walls that breathe, that I can hear all the birds and the wind and everything. Oh, it's spectacular.
Walls that breathe, that is beautiful. And most of us don't even know what that's like. I I like that. Okay. I do think there's something to be said about acclimating too. You know, I do not live in a canvas wall, Tim, but just living in Wyoming, you just get, you don't get used to it, but you get used to it. Like your body just can handle it better, I think, after time. It's funny how that works.
You just ignore it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The uncomfortability kind of just goes to the background.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Okay. So let's get into this slaughtering processing conversation. I'd kind of like to start, and I know some people listening have already gone through the mental process of figuring out why it's important to them to butcher their own animals or process their own meat, and others are kind of on that cusp. But sometimes I get so immersed in the homestead world of people who think like me that I forget there's a whole lot of people out there who can't even imagine such a thing. And I was reminded of that last night. I was at a get together, and they were not homestead folks at all. They were just normal folks, and they were talking with distaste about, oh, I would never want to know the animal I eat. I would never want to see the face of the animal I eat. And it wasn't the time or place for me to give my spiel like I do, but I was just listening to that going on. And it was like, man, we're still, as our culture, even though homesteading's rising and growing, we're still so uninitiated into this thought process. So to someone who's dancing with this idea, why would someone want to slaughter their own meat in your opinion?
Well, I think the immediacy of your body, your heart, your eyes, your hands, being in direct contact with the reality of what it is. Every time you put any food in your mouth, ever, plant or animal, it is something that died, someone that died. And so if you can directly experience the full impact of what that actually means, it will change you forever. And I think that with that comes a really deep realization of the responsibilities that we have to those lives that maybe is easy to forget about or even not know about, not even be conscious about, that we have a responsibility to everything we put in our mouths. And so when you bear witness to it and when you participate in it and you're aware of it, then it realigns. I think that's maybe why some people are hesitant to even know about it. Some of my family is the same way. They would never want to see what happens to the animal before it's on the plate. And I think it's because it is a big obligation and it can be a big responsibility. And I think maybe folks don't even know where to start with that, right? It kind of can manifest as feelings of guilt. Yeah. And that can be kind of challenging to wrestle with. And I think it's okay. You know, all feelings are valid in it. And I had similar feelings before I had my relationship with animals. So yeah, I think that it realigns you and every bite then becomes infused with this really vast kind of mycelial network of relation and obligation and praise and thanks and also the sorrow too and the grief of killing animals. And all of it is this beautiful web. And yeah, so I appreciate that when I kill, like I had bacon this morning from the pigs on the ranch and that we had cured, and I was able to share it with my family, and just that, like seeing how the kids were out there feeding the pigs every morning for 8 months or 9 months. And all of that the stories are inside of it so much more. So that's why I do it anyways.
Yeah. I like what you said about the responsibility. And I just know even before we started butchering and just learning how to cook was just the opening up that responsibility of food choices, even if it's a vegetable or it's a grain, of thinking about, yeah, this is more than just something I'm buying in a plastic packet at the grocery store. It has a story, whether that story is a good one or a bad one. And it's up to me to care more. And I think like you said, though, it's hard in our modern culture. We're so insulated that that responsibility feels foreign and weighty and sometimes scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if, you know, like I spent a lot of my life, at least half of my life, living in a city and kind of, yeah, buying food from the store and not being that conscientious, and kind of then having the awakening of, oh man, I really have been taking a lot just to be a human being. I've been taking, and I haven't been upholding that my end of the responsibility that well. And so, yeah, it was challenging realizing, wow, how many animals have I killed indirectly that I never said thank you for, that I never, gave any kind of gratitude to. And so it can be overwhelming, but that's okay. you know, it's okay. And there's ways to, I think, ways to move through that and start aligning yourself and your life and your how you move through the world in a way that can kind of start to balance, to tip that guilt balance, if you will, a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that guilt is being poured on a little heavier now in culture and media than even before. I think we have that, we carry that a little bit automatically, but I feel like it's especially heavy lately with the messaging we're getting. So being able to counteract that is powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think slaughter is for everyone?
I was thinking about this question before we started. I don't. And I think that probably throughout the whole world, through human history, there's been people in the village or in the tribe or in the town that it just wasn't their calling. And that's valid. And I think, too, it might be important for even those folks to at least witness animal slaughter or be around it even once, you know, just to really to sink in to the realities of what it is to be alive, because we're only alive because of death. So I think to sink into that a little bit. And I have friends that witnessed it once, maybe even killed an animal once or twice, and then decided, you know, it wasn't their path. They had other niches to fill in the biodiversity of human culture. And that's cool. You know, that's really cool. Like, I'm not a basket weaver. I've woven a couple baskets, but I'm not spending all my time harvesting willow and weaving. And, you know, it doesn't mean that I'm avoiding responsibility or something.
Sure. Yeah, I think we all do have those different callings. As long as, I think as long as we're not hiding, putting our heads in the sand necessarily, we don't have to always be butchering every single pound of meat that we eat, depending on the personality. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would you define a humane death or an ethical death? Because I know sometimes this is tricky to talk about, especially online, when I hear regenerative farmers or ranchers talking about humane slaughter or humane processing. Sometimes people on the internet get really upset because they're like, there's no such thing. I believe there is. How would you define that?
Man, it's a really vast, vast question. And I don't think that there's one answer. And I don't think it's simple. And I think that that question is it's kind of my perennial question every time we start to embark on a slaughter. It bubbles up, and my friends and I, my community and I, we're always learning new facets of it. So I used to think that death had to be absolutely quick, immediate, supposedly painless. That was kind of the story I was given, right?
It's
quick and painless. And when I worked at the butcher shop in Montana and we were doing mobile slaughters, you know, we were using a 22 mag and we'd go out and usually drop them with one bullet. And even the most effective bullet possible, most effective shot, it still takes, it's not immediate. I've never seen an immediate death ever. And so, but I prided myself on that efficiency. I thought it was the best way, like most humane way. And my understanding has kind of started to broaden a little bit more. And this is a really sticky topic for people, especially. You know, I was super disconnected from death for a lot of my life. And so I only had the story given to me. I didn't have my own lived relationship with animals dying yet. And so I started thinking about, for instance, let's say wolves, you know, hunting down a deer and how it can take them 24 hours to kill the deer, you know, and sometimes it can look really brutal and violent. And I thought, well, okay. And I was looking at a lot of animal death, and it's most often not quick and not painless. And I thought, well, does that mean that the wolves are inhumane? And is that what makes humans different? Is we have this different understanding of what death should be? And I kind of wanted to look at different ways people around the world view animal death and slaughter. And I wonder if our relationship, like the quick and painless cultural story, might come from death phobia.
Yeah.
Of feeling really, really uncomfortable with what death looks like. And so wanting it to be over as fast as possible, or that they look like they're just falling asleep or something.
Yeah.
And so kind of unpacking that death phobia a little bit in my own life and my own ways. I thought, well, a lot of times death is a little bit slower and there's some pain involved and maybe that's proper. And this is like really a taboo thing to say, but I wonder about it. And I don't know the answers. I'm not saying I like to torture animals before I kill them, but the slowness, like for instance, bleeding an animal out rather than shooting it, you know, maybe animals are more used to being bled out because they've lived, they've evolved. If you believe that story, like they've lived so long being hunted by other animals that usually either asphyxiate or bleed them out. Instead of having a bullet enter their brains and exploding them really fast. And so I thought, okay, well, if animals are more used to a slower, and bleeding out an animal maybe is a few minutes. It's not, you know, necessarily this long drawn out, like I'm not taking 24 hours like a wolf. But I thought maybe there's something that happens, and maybe it's true for humans too. Like there's something that happens, a process that happens that allows us to die in a different kind of way than this like very quick, like really aggressive explosion.
Yeah.
And so I don't shoot animals. I haven't shot an animal in a long time, mostly since I've worked at the butcher shop. So now I usually use a knife when appropriate. Obviously some animals like pigs or cows, that's a lot trickier. So guns are practical for that. But I don't know exactly what humane is, but I think it's broadened my what's acceptable to me. Like, you know, if for instance, hunting, I shoot an animal and they didn't drop with the first bullet and maybe it was a longer process of them bleeding out. I don't have this really intense guilt that I used to carry, where I would think, oh my gosh, I just messed this one up and I can't believe I did that. I'm so bad at like, I shouldn't be doing this. You know, I had all the like really intense guilt around it, or even slaughtering an animal. Sometimes I would get off a little bit and maybe had to use a second bullet, but I realized that there was this panic inside of me. If it wasn't quick and painless, there was a panic. And the panic actually, I reacted from panic and anxiety. And I think that I ended up causing more pain to critters, maybe shooting them another time when it wasn't necessary because they were already dying, but I was just so uncomfortable with it. So anyways, like kind of reestablishing my comfortability with that death can be a little bit slower and there's some pain and it's like birth, you know, like there's something really potent and powerful, and maybe being able to sit with that pain and that little bit of time, that longer time, a little bit better without the anxiety around it. I think that's a way of honoring these animals in their dying process. And so kind of, I think it is important to kind of undo that quick and painless story just a little bit, you know, just so that we can be of service to these animals in their dying time, rather than kind of project our anxiety on them.
That is fascinating. And I love that you're willing to ask those questions and go beyond just kind of the pat answer to that. And also the analogy with birth, we accept that birth is a process that has pain involved. So it would make sense that death would potentially also be a process with pain involved, and that would be the natural order. So fascinating. Good things to think about. Hey friends, I'm just interrupting this episode for a second to give a shout out to our other sponsor, the Modern Homesteading Conference. So this is really exciting because up until now, all the big homestead conferences and events mostly happened on the East Coast. And that meant if you live out west, then you're either driving a long ways, you're flying a long ways. And that just makes things a lot more complicated when you have animals and gardens and all the things as we do. However, that is changing this year. So the Modern Homesteading Conference is a brand new event. It's going to be held in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. It's live and it's 2 full days filled with your favorite homesteading experts like Joel Salatin, Homesteading Family, Melissa K. Norris, Anne of All Trades, Farmstead Meatsmith, and many, many more. I was looking at their website and it's a great lineup of speakers. So not only are you going to get all that valuable knowledge and the skill sets that are going to help you be more self-sufficient no matter where you live, but you also get the bonus opportunity to enjoy a concert by Grammy Award-winning farmer and filmmaker Rory Feek. You know, I love Rory. He's been on my podcast. He visits our homestead every year. He's a dear friend. So that's a big treat, all the homestead knowledge by day and a concert with Rory at night. So classes will include raising a family milk cow, on-site live butchering and curing demos, like that's pretty darn cool, homestead income classes, four-season gardening, cheese making, homeschooling, sustainable agriculture, and tons more. So don't miss out. Tickets are on sale now. Head on over to their website to see all that is included in the event and to save your ticket. The website is modernhomesteading.com. And now back to our episode. Do you have any, I don't know what to call it, rituals or ceremonies or things you do when you take the life of an animal? Is there anything you do just to kind of honor that, or just patterns that you follow?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in the beginning days, it was much more elaborate, you know, and now I've kind of, it's kind of whittled down to kind of the essence of my, I suppose it would be a ritual because it's something I continue doing. And, you know, we always try to really give them, well, right, but the, I guess it starts when you start tending an animal, right? Like making sure that they have a good life and giving them food and water and loving on them. That's like where maybe it even begins. And so when you start living in a way that's of service to these critters, then I think that that can be part of the process too, all the way through the end. And, but the, you know, around the time of slaughter, we tell the animals usually that, you know, that they're, the end of their days is coming, and we talk out loud to them and explain why, and, you know, love on them a bunch. And, I think it, I like telling the animals that it's coming. So it's not just one day all of a sudden, you know, and yeah, so we have the conversations with them, and usually the day of, they have a good, good last meal. And, I like to bless my knives if I'm using a knife or a bullet, if I'm going hunting. I just like to, I often kiss my knife or my, the bullets, you know, I kiss them just to kind of bring a little bit more like awareness and love in there. And ask for like that the bullet fly true, you know, or that my knife cut true, and just kind of ask, kind of like try to align myself that I'm going to do this well, and I'm going to do it in a way that honors the animal and their life, whatever that looks like. And it changes for every critter. And I prepare, you know, we pray a lot. We pray and we sing. So I'm really blessed in this community. There's a lot of people around, a lot of women, especially, and children. And we have different songs that we've heard, we've caught, we've come up with. And so we have songs that we sing, thank you songs and gratitude songs. And we try to be really calm and really confident. And right after I slaughter, like as their spirit or their soul or their life is leaving, I put their last, like some grass or whatever little food in their mouth, and usually give a little sip of water, like, you know, as soon as they're dead, a little bit of food, a little bit of water. And we usually sit with them and let it settle in. And, you know, there's a special time when the sparkle in their eye kind of fades. And there's even a song for that, watching the starlight in their eyes fade. And when we set to it, you know, and so that's kind of the essence of how I give my gratitude and thanks. But it continues through the whole process, then the whole gutting and skinning and butchering. We have lots of songs and there's a lot of laughter. One of my friends here, I think she came up with this, you know, because we've taught classes together. And one day she's like, you cannot spell slaughter without laughter. And it, like, you know, it was kind of one of those taboo things. And so there's a lot of laughter and joy too. And, but it's also like, we cry, you know, there's still animals where I cry and go through like the whole range of emotions that might come with it. So I suppose that's like kind of the ritual or the ceremony, if you will. And then where there's spots on the land where we've killed animals, I like to just remember those spots, you know, that it's like a little portal where somebody left this realm to whatever the spirit realm or next place is for them. And so keeping the stories close. Yeah.
That's beautiful. And I think it is so important. You know, when we first started butchering years ago, and we don't do a ton, we mostly do chickens now. But I was a lot more matter of fact about it. And I think it was elementally just a discomfort with the process. So I was like very kind of cold and like, this is what we're doing. And now I feel so much more drawn as I get older towards acknowledging what's happening. And like you said, talking to the animal, which before I would have been like, that's so dumb. Like, why would I talk to the animal? But I feel like it matters. It does matter in some way that I can't fully explain, and telling them thank you. There's just something that changes when we honor that.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I really believe it matters. And I've been in scenarios where that hasn't happened, and it's not like the whole world comes crashing down, you know, sure. But it feels better for, I think, at least for the humans around. Yes. And the children really encourage that too. I mean, the children are just so, like, so involved, and they love saying thank you and like being around them. And so that helps kind of keep me in the practice too of saying thanks and talking to them.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is just that acknowledgement that this is important and it matters, and we know the weight of this, and we're doing it consciously, because there's so much in our modern lives we don't do consciously. And I think that's why it's so important in this aspect to come back and just have that moment of awareness.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I know, just with the nature of your professions and how you live and what you do, you have this intimacy with death, and you're there a lot when animals pass and you take their lives. And I've often wondered this about butchers or people in this position. Like, does the amount of death that you deal with, does that ever weigh on you? Or like, how do you process all of that? I remember once upon a time, I was talking to a veterinarian who, you know, they put down animals a lot. That's part of their job. And they just said, you know, sometimes the days where I have to put down multiple animals, it's hard. It's just hard. Even though I know it was the right thing and the owners are ready, and it's just hard. And I was wondering if you ever feel that weight.
I think I do. It has come up. And whenever I start to feel that weight, it kind of is a signal, a flag for me to spend some time wondering what it is I can do for those animals and for their families and for like the way that I'm living. And usually what it is I've gotten out of alignment a little bit, or I've done something a little bit, without the conscientious awareness piece. I've kind of gotten a little bit too mechanical with it, because obviously being a butcher, I mean, yeah, being a skinner, you know, I'd skin 20 animals a day or something, and I would just get into the zone, listening to a podcast, kind of muscle memory through it. And if I was lucky, I'd get that little feeling in my stomach of like, ooh, something doesn't feel right. And so I just use that as an opportunity to wonder, okay, well, how can I get kind of back into alignment? Like, what can I do? Can I sing a song? Can I maybe tell the story of the animal? You know, like, I think it's a little indicator that there's something else being asked of us. And I've never been necessarily weighted down in such a way that I wasn't able to process through it, you know? And I think too, like, I'm surrounded. My home is surrounded. I have skulls everywhere and hides and bones and all kinds of things from all these critters that I love so much. And so, yeah, I'm kind of inundated with the life, death thing. And I will say I'm more on the death end of things. I personally don't have my own animals I'm raising, and so I'm much more on the death side of the caretaking of the animals. And it feels good, but I think, like I said, it's also because I try to really, really spend my time, not just during slaughter time, but kind of spread out through the year, honoring them and talking about them and, you know, continuing to process different, like their feet, or the hooves, or like different parts of their organs or whatever, like having a continued relationship. So it's not just a one and done. Now I'm back to my daily life that doesn't involve them. So even in death, I feel like they're still around us, you know? And yeah, on the ranch, we have like skulls of all the critters around sprinkled throughout the land. And that's kind of nice too, that they're still present.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that you're when you do feel it, you're using it as a clue. I think that's important to listen to those things. So that's good. So you mentioned using the parts. I think that's a great segue to some of my next questions on a little bit more of the practical side. We hit on the emotional side of it, but I know you're really passionate about using every part of the animal. And I've been more and more interested the last few years into like eating offal and organ meats and things like that. But I'd love to know, I know you have some more unique ways than just a standard, you know, heart, liver sort of recipes. So give me some other ways that you use all the animals, especially the non-food uses.
Yeah. Oh man, I love this stuff. Gosh, we get really weird. We really do.
I like weird. It's good.
Yeah, we get as weird as we can get, man. I mean, really, like, we do eat everything. Like, I love eyeballs, you know, even intestines. Like, I try different recipes with the intestines, like cleaning them out and frying them or baking with them, like, which the intestines are pretty tasteless, you know, they just become like fried chips or something. And the adrenal glands, like, we even eat the, well, I eat the adrenal glands. I think it's really good. I learned that actually, my sister has a thyroid issue and I learned she was taking like desiccated pig thyroid gland. And I was like, oh, I have access to that, you know? And so, yeah, the different glands all over. We really do. I think that I have eaten everything that you could possibly think of, including the gallbladder, which is not recommended. It's just horrendous.
Okay. So, just like flavor wise, it's strong. Okay.
It tastes like stomach acid. It tastes like puke.
Oh, yeah. Sweet. Okay. Lovely.
It's not good. But I had read that some Native Americans used to put the gallbladder on the liver and eat it. So I tried that and it was not yummy. And I think that was probably a joke they were playing on someone.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, when we get weird with our recipes, you know, all kinds of things. Like, okay, I'll just give you a little example. The latest thing that we came across was putting blood from the animal into the lungs. So you keep the trachea on the lungs and filling the lungs with blood. And then you have to boil that for maybe an hour or something. It creates like a sliceable loaf of blood bread. And then we sliced that and then made French toast. And it was delicious. Everybody was loving it. It was chocolatey French toast. It was so good. That's the most kind of stuff we're into.
Creative What's recipe that? I've ever heard. Like, you win the creativity prize for like everything I've ever heard my whole life. So congratulations. Like blood sausage in Germany? I know I've heard people talk about blood sausage. Is that like, was that similar? Is that blood in casings or? What is blood sausage?
Yeah, they usually do it in intestines. Okay. Yeah, blood can be, when cooked up, it can be either sweet or savory, and it can condense, especially, like, we've done it in stomachs, too, you know, the honeycomb stomach or one of the other stomachs and critters. We filled the stomachs and then tied it shut like a big balloon and then boil that or bake that, and it turns into a sliceable loaf. I mean, we've made, like, velvet, like, chocolate cake in a stomach. Slice that and it tastes like chocolate. I mean, people who aren't familiar with it and don't know, absolutely, I've played a few tricks and they absolutely think it's chocolate, which is hilarious. That's and it's funny. So good and so nourishing. And so blood is also an egg substitute. So you can use 4 tablespoons of blood per egg in any baking recipe. And it acts exactly the same and it gives a chocolatey flavor and it's wonderful.
I'm gonna put that in my next cookbook, blood conversion. How do you preserve the blood? Because it's coagulated, I'm sure. Do you freeze it or you don't have a freezer, you live off grid. How do you preserve the blood or do you use it fresh?
Well, we use as much as we can fresh. So when you're bleeding out an animal, if you use a metal bowl and a metal whisk and you whisk it for about 4 or 5 minutes continually, it'll stay liquid. It won't coagulate. So that's a little trick. Because then it's much more usable in a liquid state. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we usually whisk it and we use as much as we can fresh. But I personally don't have electricity on the ranch, but there is electricity on the upper part of the ranch. So there are freezers and we freeze it because it's easy that way. Also, I have read that some folks in northern Sweden, which is where some of my ancestors come from, they would dehydrate it. And it would be like flakes and then rehydrate it in water to use. So, and the cool thing about blood is you know when it's gone bad. There's no mistaking it. It smells horrible. So it's something that you can play around with really safely because if it's gone bad, there's no way you will eat that, you know?
Sure.
And so, it's not like you're going to hurt yourself with it. So freezing it is good. And yeah, you get a lot of blood from one critter. So you can use that throughout the whole year, especially, for instance, when the egg production is low in the winter time.
Yes.
Blood is a great thing to use for that.
Okay. Yeah. Fascinating. How do you cook eyeballs? What are your eyeball recipes?
Slow and low, baby. Okay. Slow and low. Yep. Yeah, I mean, sometimes we eat them raw, too, because for fun, I don't know.
Why not? I mean,
you can't really eat the like casing around them, but the goo okay. on the inside is kind of like a gusher. Those old candies from the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. Sure, yeah. That's where they got the idea. Those eyeballs.
Yeah. But slow and low. And I read that there's I think there's 19 different types of cartilage in the body, and only one type of cartilage exists in eyeballs. And you need that kind of cartilage for eye health, right? To keep rebuilding your own eyes. So it's important to eat eyes. And so slow and low, like I'll maybe boil a whole head or roast a whole head for a long time. And then you get that whole chunk with the fat behind it and everything. And I think they're delicious. They're wonderful and really good for you to eat. So that's my recommendation for the eyes. Yeah.
Okay. Slow and low. Okay. Makes sense. What about do you have any creative non-food uses? Because that's something I'm really, we'd like to start, we're trying to get into tanning our own hides here. I had a gal on the podcast a few months ago who was giving me ideas, and it was really exciting. So what do you do with your hides and your bones and the hooves and all that other stuff?
Yeah. So another of my big, big passions is hide tanning. And so I brain tan. I'm not sure what your other guest, what her kind
she
of
she said to brain tan too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. So I'm also a brain tanner. And I've also started getting into veg tan or bark tan, which is a more European tradition. And so that entails boiling up different plants and barks. I kind of just experiment with whatever might be around. You make a really strong liqueur or brine, basically, and you put the hides in there, and that's a series of strengthening. And it bark tan creates more of that saddle leather or like boot leather, the stronger, more water resistant leather, whereas a brain tan is more like suede or something. And so we tan a lot. You know, we always, all the critters we kill, I try to salt their hides and save them and either teach classes with them or tan them ourselves. But there's also, you know, just rawhide too. Like, for instance, my whole floor of my house is a moose, an elk, several elk, a buffalo. And those, you know, I just fleshed them and put them in a rack or even stapled them on a fence or something just to dry raw.
Okay.
And those are great. You can put them on the wall. But I think this is what is behind me is just rawhide. They look good on the wall or on the ground. They're pretty crunchy, you know, but. So rawhide is a wonderful material, and it doesn't require all the steps that tanning does. And then you can make, because it's a hard material, you can make boxes, different kinds of containers. I make journals out of them. I'll just cut square pieces out of rawhide and use nuts and bolts and just for the binding, just super simple nuts and bolts. And then I have like these big, monstrous journals that are huge and furry. So rawhide is wonderful, and that's a super achievable thing for someone who's never tanned before. Like I said, my whole floor is rawhide. I have a lot of rawhide containers. And then the lower leg skin, it's called hawk skin, H-O-C-K, you know, for like where the hooves are right to that first joint. There's no meat really in there and very little blood. And so you can skin those lower legs really easily. And it's cool. They have little dew claws on them. Mm-hmm. And so I skin them with the dew claws still on there. And then you can sew those fresh. Just stuff it with rice. You can make water bottle holders. I wish I had one to show you.
Oh.
Water bottle holders or different kinds of bags. And then once it's dry, you just dump the rice out and you have a stiff kind of box or bag, whatever you want. The hawk skin is really cool, especially, you know, that's often something people just toss in the compost or leave. Is those lower legs because there's no meat on them. But then they have that tendon too. And that tendon on there is something I sew with. And it's really strong. People make bowstrings out of them. People back their traditional longbows for added strength with that sinew. And if you're not using the sinew for sewing, like I can get it down to needle like a thread, you know, really, really fine wow. detail and super strong. Yeah, a lot of my stitching is done with sinew. But if you don't want to use it for that, then that sinew makes great bone broth. Oh my gosh. So you skin out the lower legs. You can pop off the hooves really easily. You just boil them for a few minutes and use pliers and pop the hooves off. And then you can throw those in your soup pot, and it makes a really nice clear bone broth because it doesn't have the meat and stuff. So it's, you know, we've made gummies, for instance, like sweet gummies using the gelatin of that because it doesn't taste like meat. It's very like kind of a purified kind of gelatin.
Mm-hmm. Because I mean, I've heard or I've seen people use chicken feet. So why not use other animal feet? That makes total sense. I don't know why I've never thought of that before.
That's right. You don't want to get the hooves off because if you don't, then it tastes like hoof. You know, it tastes like a barnyard. So you don't want to pop the lower hooves off, which are cool. I mean, we make baby rattles, like take a bunch of them, string them on a thing and make instruments out of them. Trying to think of other things. Oh, we've made buttons out of the hoof because the hoof it's similar to horn, the material. And so you can, if you boil them, they get pretty soft and then you can carve them. It's almost the opposite of blacksmithing. It comes out and when it's hot, it's still really, really warm. No, I guess it's the same, isn't it? Yeah, it's not the opposite. It's like blacksmithing where you can carve it when it's warm. And then as soon as it cools, it hardens. And so we've made really nice buttons. You can polish them up really nicely and get a nice shine on them out of the hooves. So that is super fun. Of course, oh man, there's so many bones. I could talk about bones all day long. I like making bone buttons, bone pendants, that lower leg, it's hollow and there's the marrow inside. So of course you want to get to the marrow. And so slicing that up, getting the marrow out of there. And then if you keep slicing, you get these hollow pendants that make good like necklaces. Goodness gracious. There's so many. A lot of my tanning tools we'll use bones for. So for instance, the scraper that you use to deflesh and then dehair can often be a rib bone. It's like the perfect shape. And we use that and it doesn't put holes in the hide. I've made from the scapula, I've made shovels. I saw that in an old anthropological journal. I think of the Mandan people of the Midwest. You know, they had their squash and bean and corn gardens, and they would take those scapulas and put them on a stick and use them as a hoe in the garden. Yeah. Awesome. So, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There's just so many fun things you could do. Yeah.
I think it's just, I think I need to think outside of the box a lot more, like a lot more, because I've been shortchanging all the possibilities.
Yeah. Right. And you know what has really helped me? I've been really thankful to Indigenous and First Peoples all over the world. That's kind of what I nerd out about is kind of going through these old anthropological books or, you know, the big, like big full color pictures of different Native American groups and societies. And sometimes in those old photos, you can see these old bone implements, you know, in the background or out to the side or something. And that's where I've found a lot of these different kind of things. I'm like, oh man, I wonder if I could make that. And then I try it out and try a couple times, make some mistakes and kind of dial it in. And so you can find out a lot. Just kind of like looking at, I mean, how are people have been and still are all over the world. I mean, the Sami of Northern Sweden, the Ainu of Japan, like people everywhere are using bones and different animal parts. So yeah, it's kind of exciting. It's like you're piecing together all these puzzle pieces.
Yeah, it is exciting. And I mean, my audience loves, we like to do that on a much more recent element, right? As far as like the homestead world, but I feel like this is the original. So I go back even further. And that's what I've been really struck by it lately is like going back a lot farther than I thought, because there's so much wisdom that our modern culture is missing. And it's just right there. We just have to kind of dig it back up.
Yeah. The way I think about animals is it seems to me that they are a toolbox for everything we need to live within the animal, right? Like they have the brains to tan their own hides. They even have, the deer have needle bones kind of in one of the front or the back legs. I kind of forget. There's a bone kind of right by the dew claw that's sharp and pointed and looks like a needle. And so you have to make a hole in it, but there's a needle bone and it's right next to the sinew that you would sew with. And there's the scraping tool, like all of it's all inside of them. And it's just, it's a miracle. I mean, I don't know how else to describe a miracle that they're so generous. They have so much for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the toolbox analogy. Yeah. Good. Awesome. So I want to be respectful of your time. So I just have, well, two questions. And one, the one is about roadkill, because you mentioned that at the beginning, and I have never had anyone talk about roadkill on the podcast. And I think it's intriguing, and it's also such a taboo. Tell me how do you do that? And how did you get into it? And what should someone know? Because I feel like it's such a wise way to use an animal that has died accidentally, but we have such this foreboding about it in our culture.
It started years ago. I was living in Olympia, Washington, and I remember the first day I ever picked up a roadkill. I was riding my bicycle and there was a dead squirrel on the ground, and I went past him. But I swear, I heard this squirrel say, "If I was a dead human, would you pass me up?" And maybe it was my own thoughts or whatever. But I was like, whoa. And I stopped my bike and I thought, whoa, right. If that was a dead human on the road, would I just go by them? Like, how is this okay? So I went back to the squirrel. And at that point, I couldn't even touch. I was so freaked out, you know, and I was doing the like, thing. And eventually was able to get him into a bag and I took him home. And I didn't know anything about skinning animals or butchering or anything at that point. And so I ended up just sitting with him until I could touch him, like such death phobia. I was so afraid until I could touch him and hold him and look at him. And then I buried him in the yard because that felt more appropriate than letting him, you know, rot on the pavement somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I started picking up roadkill that way. And I was just burying roadkill in the yard. And then there was a shift that happened where I thought, man, there's something else. I was a vegan too, by the way. I was a vegan. And I thought there's something. I remember hearing that humans used to use every part of the animal. I didn't even know what that meant. And so it kind of propelled me into this, well, I should skin them. I don't know. And so kind of like a baby on my like brand new legs walking towards this animal processing. And so I was skinning a lot of critters and, you know, eventually started eating them and learned how to tan their hides and all of that. And so I've picked up a lot of animals. And, you know, back in the day, it was like, who knows how stinky they were and rotten. And I didn't know anything. So I was just going for it. And I never once got sick. I've never been sick from roadkill. But how many times have I gotten food poisoning from a restaurant, you know?
Right.
So I've never been sick, and I've eaten some pretty gnarly critters. But now my understanding is a little bit different. So basically you have, you know, a 9 to 10 hour window in a warm climate from when an animal gets killed to when maybe their guts are starting to warm too much and it's going to start fevering the meat and going sour a little bit. But so you have a pretty wide window. And even if, say, you come up on a critter and they're looking like the guts are pretty expanded and it's looking green, even though it has like a deer has a green belly, sometimes, a lot of times, the legs, the quarters, the back strap, that's still fine. And so that was something that took me a while to realize. I'd see a green belly and think, nope, the whole meat, the whole animal is bad. But it's usually just the guts that are.
Okay.
And so my recommendation to people is use your nose. Our noses are designed to tell us what's okay to eat. It's really simple, actually. And so if I find a critter that's a little bit questionable, I might, you know, move them off the road. Don't do this on the side of the road because it's dangerous, but find a little spot, move them off the road. And I might take the back quarter, walk away from the roadkill because that smell of the guts is going to kind of invade. Walk away, smell the meat. And if the meat smells good, it's good. If it smells like you don't want to eat it, then don't eat it. You know, it really is that simple. And a lot of times the meat's totally fine. And I really don't think that there's much danger in eating roadkill. I think it's a cultural taboo. Like, I mean, I've been in places where a deer just got hit and somebody was going to to shoot it, to put it out of its misery. And he was like, oh, you can't eat that. Because I showed up, you know, to get the deer. And he's like, oh, you don't want to eat that. And I was like, but why? I don't understand it. I don't know. It's, people have this kind of thing where if you kill them, if they get shot or something, then it's fine. But if they get hit, it's not fine. But
yeah,
I think it's absolutely fine. And I think it's a good way to honor them too, that they got smashed by someone who might not have even stopped, not even thought about maybe that they just killed, you know, this being. And so, yeah, I mean, we get deer all the time, and check your local regulations. It is illegal in some places. It's
that's legal what I was thinking. Where I'm at. Okay.
Yeah. It's legal where I'm at to pick up roadkill. And some places will let you get it for your dog, and then like for your dog, you know, and then you can eat it. If
right.
You want.
Yeah. I've had milk for my dog before too. So,
yeah. Yeah. So being mindful of that kind of stuff, and I think it's a great thing. I mean, that's why, you know, I ended up breaking my veganness and I was only eating roadkill because I still didn't have that my own relationship with killing animals, and it felt like a really good thing to do.
That's interesting that you broke your vegan. Would you say vegan fast? Is that how you put it?
Well, yeah, my veganism. I actually broke my veganism eating a rat. So that was the first animal that I killed, was in the house with a rat trap. It was eating all my organic food, and I killed it. And that was when I was like, oh my gosh, I have to eat this animal and use every part. And so I ended up eating the little rat. Well, it was a pretty big rat.
Yeah.
Eating the rat. And I started tanning rat skins because we had a rat infestation. So then, yeah, we were like tanning rat skins and eating it. So that's how I actually broke my veganism. But then eating the roadkill was like what got me back into eating meat again.
Okay.
You know?
That is fascinating. So you were a vegan just because you didn't like the thought of killing animals, like needlessly. And then that the rat was just that awareness opening back up and then moving into the roadkill. That's one heck of a vegan transition story. I don't think I've ever heard it like that. That's awesome. But you know what I like about you is you're thinking outside the box in all the areas. You're willing to question your beliefs and question, you know, your paradigms. And it's awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, you're going to go all in. So,
that's right.
Oh my goodness. This is fantastic. So my last question for you is, let's say someone's listening to this and they're wanting to raise and process and butcher their own meat, whether that's a steer or a pig or chickens, they feel that pull, but they have that hesitation. They're nervous. They're not sure if they can do it. They're not sure how they'll feel. What advice do you have for them to get over that hump?
My advice is that you are worthy. You are worthy of taking those steps. And that the confidence in the act, the confidence in the, whether you're using a knife or a gun, it's the confidence in yourself and your ability to do this well that is going to really honor that animal and their death process. And so having that confidence also means that it's okay if the death doesn't look immediately quick and painless. And it doesn't mean you made a mistake, and it doesn't mean you're a bad person or that you're inhumane. It's that we're learning. And I think that the animals are so generous with us. That's one of the big gifts they have is allowing us to learn and to come back to balance with them. And yeah, so just knowing that it's okay to make a mistake. It's okay if the bullet went off a little bit or you didn't cut through all the way with the knife or something, and just steady yourself, have confidence, and then continue with the knife or with the bullet. But just be steady in yourself and have that confidence. And no matter how much experience you have, I still make mistakes sometimes slaughtering. And it's a proper way. Like, we're not going to be perfect. And we can let that perfectionism go. We really can.
Yeah. Be steady in yourself. I think that's good advice for all of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Amazing. Harmony, this was so good and so enlightening and so interesting. Thank you. where can folks, or is there someone, or is there some place that people can find you online? Or I know you have the website. Is there anywhere else that you would have people go to learn more about what you do and what you offer?
Yeah, I do have my personal website, and that's harmonycronin.squarespace.com. And you can get on there and kind of see what I'm up to and some pictures of my projects and stuff. And then we do have a little folk school that we've started. So that website is gatheringways.com. And that's where we have some of our classes posted. And mostly the classes, also pictures. And I think my sweet sister is doing some like food recipe stuff on there as well. And I think that, yeah, it's also on Instagram. So I personally don't run the Instagram, but somebody else involved does. So it's just at Gathering Ways. And so Instagram has a little bit of photos. We're not too much on the internet because the access is a little bit hard, but
sure.
At Gathering Ways on Instagram, you can see what we're up to. And yeah, and I think if you Google Harmony Cronin, there's a bunch of stuff that pops up too. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. And we'll drop those links in the show notes, but this was so good. Thank you for your time and your wisdom and sharing your thoughts. This was extremely enjoyable. I loved our chat.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.